Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Our Earth is in big trouble. The Earth and our economy are in crisis. Statements we've heard before. Essentially, we've created a bubble economy in which we are overconsuming the Earth's natural resources. Nowhere is this more evident than in the food sector, where record high temperatures and falling water tables are causing food production to decline. Most visible is the shrinking world grain harvest, which has been inflated by overpumping aquifers, a practice that virtually guarantees a future drop in production when the aquifers are depleted. In this edition of Radio Curious, we'll visit with Lester R. Brown, the author of Plan B, Rescuing a Planet Under Stress and a Civilization in Trouble. Lester R. Brown is the president of the Earth Policy Institute, a nonprofit interdisciplinary research organization based in Washington, D.C. Brown points out that the current water shortage in China, where the grain harvest has already decreased by more than 50 million tons in the past 4 years, the 1.3 billion consumers of that nation will compete with U.S. consumers for U.S. grain, having the potential to cause skyrocketing food prices worldwide. If you go to the internet at www.earth-policy.org, you'll be able to obtain a copy of Plan B, Rescuing a Planet Under Stress and a Civilization in Trouble. I spoke with Lester R. Brown while he was visiting San Francisco, California, in late September of 2003, and asked him to explain what he suggests is the only feasible option, Plan B, a worldwide plan to stabilize population and climate before these issues spiral out of control.
We've seen enormous growth in the human enterprise over the last century in particular. We've seen world population growth more than double. Incomes have nearly tripled. And when you put it all together, the global economy has increased more than sixfold over the last half century. And we're beginning to put enormous pressure now on some of the Earth's natural systems. In effect, we're creating a bubble economy. That is an economy whose output is artificially inflated by the overconsumption of natural capital. We're overcutting forests, overplowing land, overpumping aquifers, overfishing, overgrazing. There's not a major natural system that is not being overburdened. And the problem with a bubble economy is that eventually the bubble bursts. And the challenge to our generation is to deflate this bubble before it bursts.
I presume that if it is not deflated before it bursts, we're going to have lots of problems in future generations. But taking aside the personal relationships that we have among each other, that would pretty much level off the species, just as it's done with other species over the millennia.
No species keeps increasing indefinitely in a finite environment. And that applies to us as well as to others. I mean, we've been very successful in pushing back some of the limits, but we're now reaching a point where we're going to have to deal with these. And I should point out that in looking at some of the consequences, we're not talking about something that may happen decades or generations from now. We're going to see some of the consequences within the next few years.
Can you tell us what those are?
When I look at the global economy through an environmental lens and see the bubble that's developing, it's most pronounced in the food sector. And probably the resource that's being most overused in the food sector is water. And what we're finding is that water tables are now falling in large areas of the world, including in each of the big three grain producers, China, India, and the United States. These three countries account for roughly half of the world grain harvest. And the sort of historically recent availability of pumps, diesel and electrical pumps, that give us the capacity to deplete aquifers is leading to falling water tables throughout the northern half of China, in most states in India, and in the southern Great Plains of the United States, in the Southwest, including, of course, California. And we forget how important water is to our food supply. For example, we typically consume, each of us, about 4 liters of water a day. We drink about 4 liters of water in the form of water or juice or coffee or pop or beer or what have you. But the water required to produce the food we consume each day is at least 2,000 liters.
That's 2,000 liters per person per day.
Per person per day. So water is a terribly important resource in the food equation. And the degree of overpumping is now extensive. And the scary thing about it is that overpumping is a way of satisfying our food needs today that almost guarantees a future drop in food production when aquifers are depleted.
How soon do you see this depletion occurring?
It's beginning to happen in a lot of places now. There are each year thousands of farmers in the southern Great Plains of the United States who abandon irrigated agriculture and go back to dry land farming. For example, if you fly across the country and fly, or if you fly from the East Coast, Washington or New York, to Denver, as you're flying over western Kansas and eastern Colorado, you see these green circles in the down below. And these green circles are in the center of each of them is a well that goes down into the Ogallala Aquifer. The Ogallala Aquifer is a huge aquifer under the Great Plains. Goes from South Dakota all the way down to the Texas Panhandle. And that aquifer is a fossil aquifer, and it is being depleted. And it's more shallow on the southern end. So a lot of farmers in Texas, Kansas, Oklahoma, and in eastern Colorado have been abandoning irrigated agriculture.
Is that aquifer finite, or does it re-irrigate itself through other sources?
It's essentially a fossil aquifer, which means it's water that was put down, you know, eons ago in geological time, and it doesn't have much recharge. So when it's depleted, irrigation is pretty well finished.
And then where will that water go that's being used for irrigation?
The underground water?
That's right.
To the extent that we pump water from underground and reduce the amount stored underground, then it raises sea level. In the hydrological cycle, that's sort of where it's transferred to.
Which is another aspect that comes from global warming that also raises sea level.
Yes.
Tell us about the problems that you anticipate with the reduction of water for agriculture. What can we expect to see, and when can we expect to see it?
There have been a few small countries that have depleted aquifers, and their grain production has, you know, been cut in half in some cases. Saudi Arabia would be a case in point. But Saudi Arabia, as an agricultural producer, is pretty small potatoes in the global picture. But now, for the first time, we're seeing a large grain producer. We're seeing grain production falling in a large producing country, namely China. China happens to be the world's largest grain producer and consumer, and its grain production went from, say, 90 million tons in 1950 to 390 million tons in 1999. In the last few 4 years, it has dropped to 330 million tons. This drop of 60 million tons is due in large part, though not entirely, to the loss of irrigation water by farmers. And what this means is that China has been covering the shortfall by drawing down its once huge reserves of grain. But they're now pretty well drawn down, and within another year or two, China will have to cover this shortfall by turning to the world market. When it does, it will automatically become the largest grain importer ever. Japan, which is now the largest, imports 26 million tons of grain. And this is going to create a fascinating geopolitical situation, because we're looking at the prospect of 1.3 billion Chinese consumers who have a $100 billion trade surplus with the United States. That's enough. That surplus alone is enough to buy our entire grain harvest twice over. So we're looking at Chinese consumers competing with us for our grain, driving up food prices for us and for the world. And I don't think the world is quite ready for this yet. But I think what will happen is the Chinese will realize that for the first time in their history, they are going to be heavily dependent on the outside world for food, and we will realize that we're now sharing. We will be sharing water shortages with the Chinese via the international grain trade. And I think at that point, everything will change in how we view the world and our role in it.
What do you envision those changes to be?
Well, I mean, it would be tempting for a U.S. president faced with rising food prices, and I don't think there's any economic indicator that's more politically sensitive than food prices. It would be tempting to say to the Chinese, get lost. And, you know, 25 years ago, we would have said exactly that. But today, the Chinese economy is the engine that's pulling the entire Asian economy along. Because, as you know, the Japanese economy has been flat in the water for the last decade. But more than that, the Chinese economy is the only large economy in the world that has a full head of steam at the moment. In a sense, it's sort of powering the global economy to some degree. So we have an interest, we the United States, we have an interest in a politically stable China. And if we were not to allow them access to our grain supplies, then that would create political instability there and could be a very, very disruptive.
Well, the Chinese economy is also the economy that produces the vast majority of the American consumer products.
That's right.
So if we cut off the grain, they're likely to cut off the products that many of us rely on.
No question. Low-cost consumer goods in this country originate in large measure in China. The other interesting thing about this linkage today is that water scarcity used to be a local issue, but now increasingly as countries push against the limits of their water supplies, as in the Middle East, for example, where every country is pushing up against the limits, then they satisfy the growing need for water in cities by taking irrigation water from agriculture. They then import grain to offset the loss of production. And the reason for this is that it takes 1,000 tons of water to produce 1 ton of grain. So if you have a water shortage in the country, a water deficit, the easiest way to fill that is to import the water in the form of grain. And that's what many countries are doing now. So in a sense, trading in grain futures now is trading in water futures. Grain is the currency that countries use to balance their water books, if you will.
I'd like to take a moment and say that on Radio Curious, we're talking with Lester R. Brown about his new book called Plan B, Rescuing a Planet Under Stress and a Civilization in Trouble. Les, you haven't talked about the water that is used by people for non-agricultural means. Toilets use potable water of approximately 4 to 5 gallons a flush.
You know, the sort of flush-and-forget mentality that underlies most sewage disposal systems uses an enormous amount of water. And this is one of the things that I think is probably going to change over time. We're going to realize we can't afford to use all this water to try to wash things away. And this is true with industrial waste, too. I mean, the basic philosophy is get a lot of water and try to wash it away. But sometimes there's no way to wash it to anymore. You know, it ends up in someone's water supply or what have you. So I think we're going to have to rethink how we dispose of waste, both human and residential waste and also industrial waste.
Well, there's several areas in the rethink topic. One is the use of water, the production of food, and the use of wastewater. What are your thoughts? How have you rethought about this and addressed it?
Well, the one thing that is obvious to me at this point is that we have to begin thinking about water productivity. I mean, we routinely talk about labor productivity and land productivity, but even here in California, you rarely ever hear anyone talking about water productivity and saying, well, we've raised the productivity of water by, you know, 15% over the last 5 years or what have you. It's not even part of our working vocabulary. But I think we're going to have to do with water what we did with cropland a half century ago. Coming out of World War II, we looked ahead toward the end of the century and saw enormous growth in population, but not much new land available for plowing. So we concentrated on raising land productivity, heavy investment in agricultural research, in extension services, in farm credit things, in support prices for farmers. A lot of countries had ceiling prices on farm products, India, for example. And we convinced them to remove the ceiling prices, which were catering to urban elites, and replace them with support prices to farmers to encourage farmers to invest and expand their production.
The problem with what I hear you saying is stuff that's beyond the control of the average individual. These issues are in control of the politicians who are going to not want to address any change in the paradigm of the goods and services that the typical American uses and wants. But what can we do as individuals?
Right. You're right on target, Barry. What we're looking at now is the need for systemic change. You and I can turn off the lights and use electricity more efficiently, but if it's coming from a coal-fired power plant, it's still going to cause global warming. So we need to change the system, and that means becoming politically active. Saving the planet is not a spectator sport. We're going to have to become politically active. That means supporting candidates who are sensitive to these issues and also being willing to take the time and lobby our political representatives on these issues when they come up for consideration. But the thing that I think is going to happen is that when food prices start to rise in the next 2 or 3 years, and they could rise dramatically, rising food prices will begin to drive policy, and we suddenly will have a new lobby, for example, for climate stabilization, for reducing carbon emissions, because consumers can become a potent lobby when they're agitated or mobilized on some issue like rising food prices.
Still, they become a potent lobby, but are you saying keep the chain of production the way it is, where most people get their food at a large supermarket, or are you saying something else?
The key to building the sort of economy that can sustain economic progress in environmental terms is to get the price right. And, for example, in this country, if you look at, you know, where our food comes from, some of it comes from thousands of miles away. And the reason it does is because energy is so cheap. But the interesting question is, what is the cost to society of burning a gallon of gasoline, not the cost of getting the oil out of the ground, refining it into gasoline, and getting the gasoline to the local service station? We know what that cost is. But there's another cost, and that is the cost associated with air pollution, with acid rain, with climate change. And the climate change cost could be extraordinary. Example, CDC did a study on the cost to society of smoking a pack of cigarettes, an excellent study.
And that's the Center for Disease Control.
Right. And they looked at the cost of smoking-related illnesses in terms of the medical costs and in terms of reduced worker productivity. Their conclusion was that the cost to society of smoking a pack of cigarettes is $7.18. Now, someone pays that, maybe the employer, maybe the individual, maybe taxpayers covering Medicare costs. But the interesting question is, what's the cost to society of burning a gallon of gasoline? And is it more or less than that of smoking a pack of cigarettes, for example? And my guess is that it's going to be very high. And one of the reasons I think it's going to be very high is because we're now in a situation where rising temperatures and record heat waves are taking the edge off of the world grain harvest. We saw last year India and the U.S. had reduced harvests because of intense heat and drought. This year, it was Europe. I was reading an AP story this morning that 19,000 people in Europe died in that heat wave in August. But the a life-threatening heat wave of the sort they had is also a crop-withering heat wave. So crops all across Europe, from France in the west to the Ukraine in the east, all those countries suffered reduced harvest this year because of intense heat. And if it becomes clear that higher temperatures are leading to higher food prices, then the pressure to do something about climate change and carbon emissions in particular will intensify.
But it seems to me that the people who are the most influential in making these changes on a political level are the ones with the most money, and they are the ones who would like to have the most privacy, which they get by driving around in their cars by themselves. And they're the ones who would be able to have the most discretionary income to spend on the fancy car, to drive alone. 4 out of 5 people believe in practice there should be one person per car, yet they're not going to change. What can you anticipate in this area?
One of the things that I did in looking at the need for economic restructuring to deal with the environmental threats like falling water tables and rising temperatures and so forth was to look at the economic history of World War II. And among other things, I read President Roosevelt's State of the Union address, January 6, 1942. This is 1 month after December 7, 1941. And in it, in this address, he laid out the goals for producing arms. He said, we're going to produce 45,000 tanks, 60,000 planes, 20,000 artillery guns, 6 million tons of shipping. We only had 1 million tons at the time, and it was an enormous logistical challenge because we were fighting wars on the far side of, you know, two vast oceans.
So is what you're asking, how can we get a current political leader to characterize this threat in the same magnitude as the threat that was to this country in 1942?
Yes, and I think we're going to get it. And let me just make one further point. You were mentioning automobiles. Roosevelt and his colleagues realized that the greatest concentration of industrial power in the world at that time was in the U.S. automobile industry. And so, because even during the Depression, we were making 3 or 4 million cars a year. So he called in the automobile leaders after his State of the Union address and said, you know, we're going to count on you guys to produce most of these arms. And they said, well, you know, we're going to give it our best shot, but it's going to be difficult, you know, producing all these cars and arms too. He said, you don't understand. We're going to ban the sale of private automobiles in the United States. And that's exactly what he did. And from April of 1942 until the end of 1944, there were no cars sold in the United States. And the entire automobile industry was converted to making tanks and planes and munitions, all sorts of armaments to support the war effort. Most Americans don't even, I mean, most can't remember it, obviously, but most don't know it either. The question is, in a sense, what will be the Pearl Harbor in the battle to save the planet? And my best guess is right now that it's going to come on the food front, because it's not only rising food prices, affecting us in a consumer sense, but it's the effect of rising food prices, particularly if they're dramatic rises, on low-income developing countries around the world that import part of their food supply. And the political stability there, the political instability, could disrupt the global economy and economic progress for the entire world.
I hope that in our conversation and your work in general, you have agitated a lot of people into a state of active concern. But in a few words, what direction can you give to the agitated people to resolve this issue?
I come back to the point I made earlier. We have to become politically active, and that means supporting political candidates who recognize and will work on these issues, and it means becoming active on particular issues when they're up for consideration at the, you know, at the town council level, at the state level, at the national level, and lobbying, writing, calling, even going to Washington if need be to lobby our representatives there.
Well, Lester R. Brown, author of Plan B, Rescuing a Planet Under Stress and a Civilization in Trouble. Thanks very much for talking with us on Radio Curious. And before we close, is there a book that you've read recently that you could recommend to our listeners?
I can, but first let me say that Plan B is available online free of charge at earth-policy.org, which is our website for anyone who wants to browse or download. The book that I have read that has made a deep impression on me is a book called Endurance. And it's about a group, an effort by a group of Brits in, I think it was 1916, to reach the South Pole. And their ship got trapped in ice. They lost their ship. And it took them a year and a half surviving under the unimaginably harsh conditions before they finally reestablished contact with the outside world and were rescued. So it's a remarkable story that sort of restores one's confidence in what we can do under stress if we have to.
And who's the author?
I can't remember the author. In fact, there are two or three books, but the one is Endurance, and the key name is Shackleton. There are actually business schools now that teach courses in Shackleton management.
Lester R. Brown, thank you very much for joining us on Radio Curious.
I've enjoyed it, Barry.
Lester R. Brown is the author of Plan B, Rescuing a Planet Under Stress and a Civilization in Trouble. He is the founder and president of the Earth Policy Institute, a nonprofit interdisciplinary research organization based in Washington, D.C. The book that he recommends is Endurance by Alfred Lansing. You can obtain a copy of Plan B by going on the internet to www.earth-policy.org. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious are available. There are over 750 archives on our website, radiocurious.org, and I'm honored to tell you that Radio Curious is now part of the collection at the Library of Congress. We appreciate your cards, ideas, and letters, and do enjoy hearing from you. The email is curious@radiocurious.org. The postal address is 700 West Smith Street, Ukiah, California, 95482. The phone is 707-621-5075. Ignacio Ayala is the assistant producer. I'm host and producer, Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.